Category E6, Sports Broadcaster, Jer Gilroy.
Everybody wants me to ask you about retirement, but it strikes me that everybody's been asking you about retirement and that actually it's been kind of boring listening to everybody writing you off and saying, this is the end, this is the end. The one good part about it has been all the YouTube tribute videos where we just get to sit and watch some Brian O'Driscoll porn. It's like, try, amazing pass, brilliant offload. So that bit I'm okay with, but this kind of like, reach a certain age and we rush you out the door. I don't think it's good for us. I don't think it's a good way to have a conversation with you about your career generally.
It's been, to be honest with you, it's been coming for a few years, though, that line of questioning. I think you get to a point, you get 30, 31, and then, oh my God, when can we retire him?
And why do we do this?
I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is. Because you do see, now, I suppose, you see sports people, you see the likes of Ryan Giggs being able to play to 40 next year. You see Brad Thorne, Nathan Hines, Simon Shaw is going to be 40 next year. These guys, granted, they're all second rows, but there is an ability to, if you look after yourself, to play on longer. And that's the big thing, is taking care of your body and understanding what works for you and doing more in some areas and less in others. And I think that's where there's a big trust element with the strength and conditioning guys, that you're not trying to take, you know, the easy option, that they know, okay, he knows him, he knows himself, what's going to work for him getting right for Saturday. So with regard to all the retirement stuff, I've been answering them, I'm blue in the face, and I'm afraid it's the same answer. I'm just going to leave it to the end of the season and see how it feels. And I don't feel as though I'm under any pressure to pull the trigger on making the decision. I know I've been cut a bit of slack by Leinster because they can't replace me with a foreigner anyway. With the union, I just said, listen, I need to try and play the Six Nations, see how I feel, I'll make the decision when the time is right.
Yeah.
And I can't, I'm not lying to people. And people must be sick of hearing this.
Well,
they really must.
I do think it's terrible that we rush sports people out when ultimately it should be a decision that they get to make. When it's, you know, I mean, it's such a personal thing because, like, we again are just sports fans who watch, whereas you guys live this and the void in sports people's lives. And again, we talk to them about it. They're like, yeah. It did take me a long time to get over the fact that my daily routine changed. Now, you've obviously had a lot of business stuff going on in the background anyway, so I think there's probably stuff going on in your head that you can transition maybe a little bit easier than some people.
The transition thing is huge because I've seen people in the past retiring and then going, okay, what'll I do now? And struggle. Mm. So I decided I definitely, a few years ago, I needed to try and make a transition in a few areas that I had interest and keep them, try and work the early years of those into when the time was right for me to hang up the boots. So, a couple of things I enjoy doing in my downtime, albeit my downtime over the last month has lessened massively.
Yeah.
It is nice to be able to switch away from it. I don't live, breathe, eat, sleep rugby. I do enjoy my job, but I have an ability definitely to be able to switch away from it and look at other areas of my life.
Yeah, so that hopefully that'll be a much easier thing whenever it does happen, which mm-hmm. I hope is in a couple of years' time as opposed to at the end of the season. One final quick question about that last month and how it's a life-changing event. My daughter was born the night before you guys beat Australia in the World Cup, and I missed the game because I was on the way to the Labour Ward, but I just remember that first month being really on edge because there's this tiny little thing that you now have responsibility for, but also full of boundless energy. It's a weird kind of paradox, or edgy and full of energy. I don't know how you've managed to also combine playing high level international rugby with that.
It's needs must, I think. You know, every situation is different, and this is the situation I find myself in. It's great that after games it does become irrelevant what you do on a Saturday, albeit it's hugely important in your life, but not as important as what's happened when my daughter arrived a month ago. So it's exciting to be able to go back home after an international and know that I won't be judged on my performance.
Yeah.
Because you know, she's going to need the same thing she needed the previous 3 weeks. Last weekend, I arrived home with a dead leg, a concussion and a cut ear, and she didn't care much for that. So she still wanted her nose bag at 11, 3 and 7,
yeah.
And I was the man for the job.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to hobble around. Luckily, you've got good hands that you're not liable to drop stuff.
Yeah, I have to say I was delighted to be able to get away from the hospital for after the first week, where I didn't have people judging
my speed of nappy changing and feeding and stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
and
so I could just do it in my
nappies
in my in my own time and under no pressures or constraints. Yeah. So that was all good.
Nothing's better than me and, you know, nothing's better than me and Robbie Keane being thrown out of the Beverly Hills Hotel for singing Irish songs on a Sunday afternoon. You know, they just can't get that humour, you know what I mean?
Yeah. What, what's the reaction like from the crowd when Robbie's doing his tunes?
No, it's, I mean, it's good. We start off, like, very quietly, and then it gets a bit boisterous, then the girls join in, and next week we've got the manager tapping us on the shoulder. You have to keep it down or bugger off.
That's class. So, do you watch any of LA Galaxy? I guess if Robbie's playing and you're mates with him, you'll probably go along and see him play.
No, I don't really go down there. I play golf instead. That is shite football. No, I went once. I played a charity game down there once, but no, that's pretty shite, to be honest.
There's a couple of things that strike me that, you know, you're a very affable man, but actually beneath it all, when it came down to competition, the competitive urge was the strongest thing about it. That beating your brother and beating these other guys, that was there the whole time. That maybe that's in the makeup of the athletes who do go on to win gold medals.
I think it has to be. You have to be ruthless, and you have to have this enormous self-belief too, you know, without overworking it, there's an intellectual aspect, especially to the 1500 metres.
You talked earlier about not hearing any of the noise. From the Olympic final and the race itself, how much of that do you recall, or is that still a tunnel as well in your mind?
I can tell you the big picture. Big picture was I was in a good position everywhere, even though I was towards the backs of the field. The big picture was what had been drummed into my mind by Coach Elliott was relax, relax, relax. Minimise your expenditure of energy. That was there. The race, I say, only begins at the bell. Well, where was that field at the bell? It's the most classic 1500-metre race ever. The entire field is within 6 yards. I'm not that well positioned, but I'm still only 5 yards off the front. The field I know is going to break up. You know this is from experience. The bell ringer is so excited. I heard afterwards that he forgot to ring the bell. So we don't know it's the last lap. I'm only joking. We knew it was the last lap. Then you have your thinking on it is, who do you watch? You can't watch everyone, but you know you're conscious of those around you. I was conscious of people making bursts at different stages of the race. Lincoln ran from last to first. Hewson took the lead too early. He was leading going into the backstretch. Landy and I were shouldering, and not in the most gentle sense, we were shoulder to shoulder rather than shouldering. He began to move down the backstretch because he wouldn't have the sprint I had. I didn't panic. I stayed in his wake and I trailed him down the back. And these are my memories. And then what I've been taught to do is one dynamic burst. And the man who taught me that was Jack Sweeney, famous legendary coach in Ireland, my school coach. One burst, and you make this one burst, and that's all you get. You don't get two opportunities to burst. So I made that burst about 150 metres from home, 160 metres from home. You're going around the last bend, there's a huge long straight, and I was just flying, you know. God, I can't remember it specifically, but I was just flying. I mean, my legs were pumping, my arms were pumping, and I just knew I was cutting them down. Then when you hit the front, you know you're going to win, and you approach the tape, and the joy doesn't come till the exultation when you go through the tape. You throw your arms out, and then the reality hits you. You've thrown your arms out. You've won the Olympics. You're all over the world. Every newspaper in the world. Everything's your picture, iconic picture of all time. Then you suddenly say, oh, my God, I can't believe it. You know, you can't believe you won. And then I said a prayer of thanksgiving. But could I recap just a second? Because the final training session I had in America, coach goes down the track, pulls a tape across the track and says, you know, son, he says, go down and run through the tape. So I did a mock going through the tape of my arms out in exultation, and the coach comes over, Ternal puts arm around Sean, he says, son, now we've practiced everything, even breaking the tape. I think we could write this book, couldn't we?
you know, it's seeing the volcano erupt back there, you know, 8 years ago, 7 years ago, when I had the conversation with Lance, when he spoke about David, it was like seeing a volcano erupt, not rational, incredibly angry. It was as if he was, you know, channeling everything at David, and it was ugly. It was uncomfortable. And last night, you know, and the night before in the interview, you could still see the volcano there, I thought, just beneath the surface. You know, there were so many moments where it seemed like he was trying to keep his anger in control. And I thought he talked like someone in therapy, but he didn't act like someone who had made any profound changes. And so it was, I don't think it's, but in the biggest picture, I don't think it's fair to judge him on a scale of, is he the old Lance or the new Lance? I think, Tyler Hamilton, who I just wrote a book called The Secret Race with, is, you know, knows Lance well. And it was interesting to see his take. He said, look, this is, you know, it's a first step. Is it a convincing first step? You know, not entirely. But it's sort of a necessary thing. It's a necessary step if there's going to be, you know, someday, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, there'll be somebody that we can sort of recognize and say, okay, that is someone different than the guy we used to know.
Can I ask you, one of the things that we've been seeing over the last couple of days are a bunch of very high-profile American columnists, Rick Riley, Buzz Bissinger, who were personally offended by Lance's lies, now trying to distance themselves from their pretty unwavering support over a long period of time for Lance. And they're saying that, you know, this is an affront to them as much as anything, because they dared to believe. Lance obviously lied to you a lot when you were writing the books about Lance as well. What's your take on that now in terms of how, what's your relationship with that portion of Lance's career?
I look at it, it's like I'm watching someone change from a cheerleader uniform into an executioner's uniform. You know, it's insane. These guys, they talk about belief. Well, a journalist's job is not to believe. You know, a journalist's job is to report. And that's what I tried to do in my book, report the light and the dark as deeply as I could at the time. It ultimately took a guy with a gun and a badge to start an investigation that took us deeply inside. But from the start, no one honestly can say that they looked at the facts and just simply didn't think there was anything there. No one could really call them a journalist. So those guys who were making that big switch were never really journalists on this story in the first place. They were cheerleaders. They were enthusiasts. They were megaphones. And in some cases, they were used extensively, especially Rick Riley, who wrote story after story about what a fantastic person Armstrong was, glorifying him, that without doing any reporting. So to me, it's a snapshot of an unfortunate snapshot of the state of journalism in America during that period, and it maybe continues today. Here we are with this story that came out recently with a Notre Dame football player, another case of people believing a story that's too good to be true, a story that couldn't be looked at honestly with a bit of reporting.
Yeah. Final thing in terms then of a takeaway from Oprah, you've called it a massive mistake to begin this process in front of millions of people. Is there a comeback from that for Lance? What happens next, do you think?
You know, I don't know. I think he's in uncharted territory for him. It's like he's been rumbled. You know, there's nowhere left for him to go that won't seem sort of overly calculated. I think he needs to disappear. The problem is he's really not suited to that. You know, he's not suited to go away on some desert island and think about life, or go to some mountaintop and stay at a monastery for 5 years. He can't do anything without the cameras being there. And so that's what makes this sort of difficult. And you can almost see his appetite getting excited by this idea of an epic comeback. You know, at the end of that interview, when he said it's epic, you know, so he's already, you can see the wheels turning. You know, a tiger doesn't change his spots, you know, but if anything can humble a person and and bring them down to a fresh start. It's what he's gone through over the last couple of months.
It sounds like you're suggesting he might end up in a reality show, though, more likely than, say, for example, the monastery. That is where the story goes for Lance. It's like my journey back to whatever. And, you know, there is probably one of those lower cable networks who will put him on and pay him £1 million for it to make sure that he has enough to fight these incessant legal battles which are coming his way.
You know, I think that's fair to say. I'd put the money on the reality show before I put it on the monastery, for sure.
First question goes to you, Phil. It's the Phil Bob quiz of Jason McAteer.
Look at the size of air boobs.
In a 1998 World Cup qualifier against Macedonia, Jason McAteer gave away a penalty for a handball, kung fu kicked a Macedonian, and then was promptly red carded for kneeing another Macedonian in the knackers. Your question is, what colour was Ireland's jersey in that match?
I know it.
It was white, no?
Ooh!
Do I get a bonus point?
No, no bonus points, but it was orange.
Can I tell you what else it did?
It was the orange abomination, the one and only time.
Can I tell you what else it did? When I walked into the dressing room, I put my foot through their dressing room door, and because it was made of plywood, it went right through. And then I got a bill for £3,000 off the Macedonian FA for breaking their dressing room door.
That's a pretty expensive...
I didn't play in that game.
That's a pretty expensive door. Okay, Jason, we're going to play the Jason McAteer quiz of Phil Babb.
Feeling to The Cure to Luther Vandross. It is an eclectic mix.
Hey! International Madam History. So we do all remember the infamous Phil Babb Nutcracker episode.
Yes.
Think you know the answer to this one. Which Chelsea striker scored the goal that nearly saw Phil Babb cut in two by the goalpost?
Ridiculous.
This is for you. Casiraghi.
Torres.
100% correct.
Thank you.
There's only four questions, Phil.
You're going to get this one.
1-0 up.
Okay, question number two for Phil Babb. In 2009, what were Jason McAteer and John Barnes filmed doing in the Tranmere Rovers car park after the pair were sacked as the club's management team?
Trying desperately to load a mountain bike into the back of a Jeep.
Yes! Hey! It's 100% right. Is it true that one of your mates rang you up and said, you're doing that wrong?
Yeah, we were putting the bike in the back of the car and my phone went. And my mate went, turn the wheel the other way. And I went, what? He went, turn that wheel of the bike the other way. And I went, where are you? He said, I'm sitting on my couch. He said, you're live in the sky right now.
Question number two for Jason McAteer. Phil Babb scored one league goal in his Liverpool career.
Oh, stop. Get on to this. Right?
Against Coventry in September 1996. Coventry. Who had the assist on the goal?
Do you know what, right? I had Babs here bet. I won't tell you how much it was, but it was a fortune, right? And I said to him, I bet you... you don't score this season. I had he wouldn't score, and he took he would score, right? And then I went and put a cross in, and he went and scored, and I had to pay the forfeit, and it was a fortune. I crossed the ball for his goal that season.
100% correct.
Yeah. Cost me a fortune, that.
Question three for Phil Babb. Before the 2002 World Cup, Jason McAteer kept a diary for the Irish Independent. Which Ireland player is he referring to in this entry from Saipan?
Oh, no.
He's been hitting me with these one-liners, fail to prepare, prepare to fail, all week. Sometimes I think he thinks he's Alex Ferguson. You all go with the flow, he said. What do you mean? What goes with the flow? I replied, dead fish, he said. I thought, wow, profound, the Messiah has spoken.
I'm lost and I wrote it.
Oh my God.
Who do you
well,
think
it wasn't
that
Roy,
be?
Was it? It's got to be Mick, isn't it?
No. Let's play this
bit. Steve Staunton.
No, it's Roy Keane.
Roy?
Yeah.
Who always what? Used to say?
What?
He used to always say, fail to prepare, prepare to fail. That was his one-liner.
Oh, he talked.
That's the only thing he ever said to me.
Is anybody...
In 10 years...
Hang on a minute.
Oh, and you're not my mate.
You weren't even talking to
him. He did say that to me once as well. You're not my mate.
Okay, I've got one final question because this is going to be decided, I'm pretty sure. Question number three. What number did Phil Babb wear at USA 94?
Oh!
That one.
Babsy. Was it 1 to 11? You've got to give me that.
No.
I was 21. I never thought I was even going to play.
Give us a number.
Has it got a one in it?
Give us a number.
Oh, number
yeah, yeah.
What are you asking me, Raw? I don't know.
Was it an odd number?
It was number 14.
Oh, I would have gone out if you said.
Okay, question number 4 for Phil Babb. He's got to get this right, otherwise it's totally gone.
Missed his pen, yeah, that's it.
Who scored more league goals for Liverpool? Steve Staunton, league goals. Who scored more league goals for Liverpool? Steve Staunton or Jason McAteer?
Oh. Oh. That's close.
Got two against West Ham.
It's Jason.
It is. Steve Staunton never scored a league goal.
Didn't he?
No.
I was only guessing as well.
So he didn't either for Liverpool.
No. Seven,
oh, made up.
Cup goals. All right, question number 4. This is the winner. Who scored more league goals for Liverpool? Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Who scored more league goals for Liverpool? Steve Staunton or Phil Babb?
That's it! What you win?
This is the guy who didn't pick you that we're talking about as well.
How many tickets does he get?
He gets 2 tickets.
Right.
No, he's won. He's
Who's going to take me? Babsy.
It's 100% correct.
Thank you.
News Talk 106 to 108.